Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started. So today I want to talk about some variants of the LMS algorithm and show you that what we've been discussing with the standard, our standard LMS approach, is actually one of many choices in a taxonomy of LMS algorithms. So today we're going to talk, we'll talk a little bit about the taxonomy, and then we'll go through some specific variations. We'll talk about the normalized LMS algorithm, about how to do variable step size adaptation. We'll then talk about algorithms, what are sort of a class of algorithms called leaky LMS, which use what's called a forgetting factor. And then we'll talk about some simplifications to the LMS algorithm based on looking at the sign of the error signal, or the correction term. And then we'll talk a little bit about block-based algorithms, which are called smoothing algorithms. And then finally, we'll conclude with an interesting extension of linear filtering known as the Volterra filter, which will show you, introduce you to a new class of adaptive filters, or actually just filters in general. I've provided some resources to LMS. There's a pretty nice lecture here on all the different LMS algorithms, as well as some nice pointers to MATLAB stuff. Okay, so thus far we focused on one particular way of doing an LMS algorithm. The adaptive algorithm that we've chosen is LMS. The criterion that we've chosen to minimize is least squares error. The way we've proposed to do that is the steepest descent. And the implementation of the actual filter that we've primarily discussed is a what's a tap delay line, or otherwise known as an FIR, finite impulse response filter. But there are many, many different ways to do this, and I'm showing here on the right a taxonomy of these algorithms. We have the at the top node, you could say adaptive filter design options, and in the author's textbook, they branch this two ways, least squares and non-least squares. But actually, we'll see in a moment that this non-least squares is still minimizing a pseudo-quadratic type function. There's actually a lot of other branches to this, I would say, including the statistical methods that we're going to talk about in the second half of the semester. So this isn't, I would say, necessarily a complete taxonomy, but it sort of fits within the scope of what's typically taught in these adaptive signal processing courses. Under the non-least squares approach, you can think of this as any situation where you're using a non-quadratic cost function. And we'll talk about sort of two examples of that today. Under the least squares approach, there's still a lot of different things you can do. You can use the direct search. You can do a direct solution, or you can do gradient descent. We've been talking primarily about gradient descent. We've also talked a little bit about the direct solution. That would be where you'd solve, for example, the normal equations using matrix operations. And you can also think of the problem of finding the right parameters for this filter as a search problem. That's a kind of interesting interpretation of this problem that actually is used in other forms of pattern recognition. And underneath that approach, you can do some very simple things like actually randomly search the space for coefficients, or you can do more principled searches. We won't talk about this in this class, but if you take a computer science class on algorithms or pattern recognition class, we do talk a little bit about the generalized problem of finding these coefficients and different ways that can be done. Under the direct solution, we'll talk next class about a technique called recursive least squares, which we've already actually alluded to earlier. And this is a way to solve the normal equations essentially using an iterative or recursive in time algorithm. A slightly different approach than what we're doing with the adaptive filters. Under the gradient descent, all of the gradient descent algorithms obviously try to find the best parameters using a gradient type approach. Gradients are associated with first derivatives. You can actually use more sophisticated derivatives and things. We'll sort of allude to that today. But even under gradient descent, there's different ways you can do the gradient. You can use Newton's method, or you can use the method of steepest descent. Now, we've been talking mostly about the method of steepest descent. Under the method of steepest descent, we have then the sort of that narrows things down to the LMS algorithm. But even under the LMS algorithm, as we'll talk about today, there's a lot of different variants of the standard LMS algorithm, and those are what we'll introduce today. So hopefully this gives you some appreciation of how big the space is for all these different adaptive algorithms. And through the course of the semester, we'll try to cover some things beyond the LMS algorithm. But today, what we want to focus on are the things at the very bottom, the LMS variants. Now, later in the course, we're going to actually broaden the concept of adaptation. Adaptive filtering as a topic sort of evolved with around the problem of directly filtering signals, like removing noise, time delay estimation, source localization, all these kinds of things. But there's a whole other more contemporary view of adaptation where you take a model that's been trained, like a hidden Markov model, and you then try to adapt the parameters of that model based on new data. And that's a problem that we're going to discuss more or less in the second half of the semester. That's really where a lot of research has been done in the past 10 years, and it's really where sort of state of the art is. And you can also, in that scenario, not only can you adapt the model parameters, but you can also adapt the feature vectors themselves so that you can offset situations like changes in the ambient environment where you're collecting your features. So we'll talk extensively about those two problems, and we'll pose the solutions to those problems as statistical parameter estimation problems like maximum likelihood, Bayesian estimation, things like that. And we'll also pose the models for that adaptation in terms of things like linear transforms and such. And that's another whole, I would say, another branch of this kind of thing that's not really shown here. Now, if we look at the non-least squares branch, there's one fairly well-known variant of LMS involving a different cost function. We can define a cost function, which we'll write as that should not be f of n, that should be j. We can define a cost function j as the expectation of the error signal e of n raised to a power. Typically, we want error functions to be raised to even powers so that they're non-negative. And so we can write that actually as e of e to the 2n, where n can be an integer greater than or equal to 1. We can then, as we've done before, we can define an error function in our standard way, d of n minus the product of the transformed parameters f sub n and the signal x of n. We can take the gradient of this with respect to the parameters, and what'll happen, the only real difference here will be that we're going to have, instead of a set of linear equations, where instead of having this e to the, when we had e squared before, we ended up with linear terms. Now we'll just have terms of the order e to the 2n minus 1. In the previous case, we've looked at n equals 1, which means this gives us just e directly, which is a linear set of equations. But as we'll see in a moment, we can look at alternate forms of this. We can look at higher powers of n, essentially. So in this case, the update equations for the filter coefficients still remain this alpha over 2 times the gradient of e to the 2n, But the only difference now is that with this higher powers, we may not necessarily end up with a set of linear equations. Well, one very, very popular variant of this has been is something known as the least mean fourth, or LMF algorithm. And there, instead of minimizing e squared, we minimize e to the fourth. N is essentially 2 for that that algorithm. And the adaptation equations for that system are not terribly complicated. They're of the form alpha times n times e to the 2n minus 1, e to the power 2n minus 1 of n times x of n. So we just mentioned that. We won't go through the details of this algorithm, but we just mentioned that as an example of a non-least square error algorithm. Now, this is still pretty close to least square because we like the e squared of n. We like the approach that minimizes the square of the error because that's a convex space. Well, taking the error signal to the fourth power is also essentially a convex space. So this has a, like the quadratic problem, does not have the problem with local minima. But one of the reasons you might use this, if you think about what's the difference in the solution that you get when you minimize e squared versus e to the fourth power, the only real difference is going to be that when you minimize e to the fourth power, large values of the error are going to be much more important. With e squared of n, you could say that relative to e to the power 4, the balance between large variations in the error and small variations in the error will be better preserved with e squared of n. When you continue raising e to higher powers, you're basically just weighting large values of the error much more heavily than small values of the error. If you're really concerned about small values of the error, you might even consider looking at just minimizing perhaps the absolute value of the event, and we'll talk about that a little bit later today. So I don't know, you know, this is of historical significance, but I haven't actually ever seen this used in practice. So there's a lot of this, like in any research field, a lot of this adaptive filtering technology that's been developed, once the basic paradigm is used, people research and develop a lot of extensions to it. But one of the reasons I wanted you to read that equicancellation article, when all is said and done, the algorithms that are used in practice are still very simple, very basic LMS algorithms like that equicancellation algorithm. So most of these things were just sort of some amount of historical significance. So let's now talk about a variant of the LMS algorithm called the normalized LMS. And before I do that, I wanted to sort of jump down here to this equation where we show the update equations in the middle of the slide. And I wanted to point out that, you know, there's nothing, really the theme of today's lecture is there's nothing magical about this correction term. You could use almost any algorithm you want for that correction term. The key issues here are you want the correction term to be capable of changing sign, because some of the times your estimates are going to be over, some of the times your estimates are going to be under. So it sort of has to track that. So it has to change sign. You also want it to be sufficiently small that when you get close to the true value of the coefficient, you can converge to the true value. So if you use a large value, you're going to have a problem. Or if you use a constant value, you're going to have a problem. Because if the constant value is too large, then you're not going to be able to converge to the final solution. You'll just oscillate around the final solution. But, you know, other than those two constraints, there's nothing really magic about this. We'll see in a moment, you can actually just use the sign of that error term as a correction factor, and weight that by a constant. You could use random values for this correction term. In fact, some algorithms, like hidden Markov models, when they get stuck in local minima, have been known to randomly perturb the coefficients and then continue iterating so that you break out of this local minimum. So there's, despite all the high-powered math we use, there's nothing special about this term. I can impose a lot of heuristics on this term and not really significantly degrade the basic LMS scenario. And that's essentially what we're going to do today. So the first thing we might want to think about is normalization. The stability, convergence, and steady state properties of the LMS algorithm are directly influenced by the length of the filter and the power of the input signal. We saw that previously when we did the derivation of the LMS adaptation algorithms. Now, that's a problem because you would like the performance of the filter in terms of the amount of adaptation time, the time it takes to converge, and the stability. You'd like that to be independent of the power of the input signal, for example. If you don't worry about that, then you might run into a situation where the filter converges for nominal levels of the input, but if you have really large levels of the input, the filter might diverge because your correction factors are going to be too strong. This is a problem that was observed early on when people looked at echo cancelers, where when you apply echo cancelers in the analog telephone network, the problem you face is the input signals can be of significantly different levels. Even though in the telephone network they try to normalize the volume or the amplitude of the signal through the network, there is still a pretty large variation. You may recall, in days gone by, that sometimes you get a phone call and be really soft, sometimes you get a phone call and be really large. A lot of that's gone away with the digital network, fortunately, but we still have problems like that. So, and you're going to want to set, to get these algorithms to converge in a reasonable amount of time, you have to set this alpha pretty aggressively. We won't ask you to do computer simulations this semester, but if you did computer simulations, you'd realize this pretty quickly, that if you set alpha too small, it just takes forever for the filter to converge. And that's useless for an application where you have a dynamic signal like a speech signal that's changing on the scale of 5 or 10 milliseconds. So we have to set the alpha aggressively, but if we set the alpha aggressively, you quickly realize it's related to the power of the signal, which is not good, because the correction term is of the form E of n times x of n. So if x is larger, the correction term is larger. If x is smaller, the correction term is smaller. Now for things like communication systems where you have modem signals of prescribed signal strength, that may not be a problem. But for applications like acoustics or speech processing, that's a problem. That's a big problem because the signal, not only does the signal have a variation in loudness, but the signal also has a local variation in loudness. Some parts of the speech signal have a large amplitude, some parts of the speech signal have a small amplitude. So, and then on top of all of those things, you always have this problem with implementation. In the early days of this work, these algorithms were being implemented on processors that could only do integer arithmetic. And when you do integer arithmetic, I don't know, most of our students no longer get exposure to this kind of thing, but when I was a student, we had to worry about how do you actually multiply two floating point numbers to update a filter. How do you multiply two floating point numbers when you only have an integer processor? Well, the way you do this is you simulate floating point using a fixed number of bits. And one of the problems that you face when you do that is the dynamic range of the signal has to be known so you can make sure you don't overflow your accumulators. And when you have signals that vary significantly in amplitude, that's a real problem for fixed point arithmetic. So many systems over the years try to normalize the input power of the signal. And that's a technology known as adaptive gain control, and it's been used pretty effectively over the years. And this is a way, sort of an alternate to that. This is essentially a way of normalizing the correction term with respect to the energy of the signal. But you might think about, well, one of the ways we could do that up front is to simply normalize the power of the signal using something like adaptive gain control. So we can normalize the adaptation constant with respect to the length of the filter and the power of the input by simply taking our old value of alpha and dividing it by the length of the filter times the energy of the input signal. And for the energy of the input signal, we'll use the expectation of x squared of n. We'll call this product of L times the expectation of x squared of n, we'll call this T sub P. We can estimate the power of the signal using a time average. We can take the sum of x squared of n minus j, the j previous samples of the signal, and if we take that sum over L, we've essentially accounted for this L times the expectation of x squared of n, but we can also recognize that this is just a dot product of xn transpose, what we've been calling our data vector, the L previous samples of the signal. So it's pretty easy then to take the update equations and write them as fn plus 1 is equal to f sub n plus, previously we had alpha times e sub n times x sub n, but now we can take alpha times e of n times x sub n and divide that by this xn transpose xn, which is just essentially the signal power. And that gives us an ability now to set alpha in such a way that it's independent of the signal power. And that's important, and that's in fact used, for example, in that echo cancellation application that I showed you. So this is a very important practical issue in implementing these kinds of adaptive filters. But we have a little bit of a problem with this. This product, or that ratio rather, could have a fairly large dynamic range in itself, because if the signal power is small, that ratio could be very large. We have the divide by zero problem. And in fact, if the signal power becomes too small, this correction term is going to be large, which could lead to instabilities in the convergence. Now, you might say, well, for a speech signal, for example, an audio signal, me talking in this room, if you were collecting the signal, you say, well, the signal can never really, its energy could never go to zero. There's always going to be some non-zero energy. And if you're looking at sample values, typically, for example, we represent sample values by 16-bit integers. So you could say, well, the signal is never going to go down to a value that is identically zero. There's always going to be at least the minimum value the signal can attain is one, because that's the digital representation. So occasionally the signal can have values of zero, but the chance of L values of the signal being zero are pretty low. So you go ahead and write your code assuming that you don't really have to worry about this divide by zero. Well, unfortunately, in the real world, you find there's all sorts of impairments that cause these things to turn out to be zero. For example, when you're processing digital data collected over the telephone network, you will find it's not uncommon to have runs of zeros where there's been some kind of transmission dropout or transmission problem between the transmitter and the receiver. And if you look at digital data, and we have a bunch of digital data collected online, you'll find actually the data does every now and then have a run of zeros. And I can't tell you the number of times we've found that, but because our software has crashed, because somebody forgot to protect by divide by zero. In fact, I never really worried about that working with graduate students, because I knew that eventually that was the easiest way to find these problems in the data was just to find when their code would crash. Later we'll talk about that problem from a model estimation point of view, but it's really kind of a nasty problem. So to somewhat control the dynamic range of this ratio, an obvious thing to do, and we do this all the time in digital signal processing systems, is to avoid the division by zero by adding a small constant. A constant that allows this ratio, it sort of clamps the largest value this ratio can attain and prevents the denominator from going below a value c. So we call this c plus xn transpose xn, and that prevents the, that does two things. It prevents the divide by zero, but it also sort of clips the how small this value can be, which in turn clips the largest amount of perturbation of the coefficients you're going to see. Now, that's both good and bad. This is no longer the pure least squared solution. So obviously, this is going to introduce a bias in the coefficients. And you can, in fact, go through the analysis of this. It's not done in the textbook, but and show that the when you introduce a constant like this, you're introducing essentially a bias in the coefficients, that you'll prevent the coefficients from reaching their true values, and that's always a trade-off, numerical robustness versus bias in your coefficients. But for, interestingly enough, for situations where the input, where the noises that you're encountering in your system are zero mean Gaussian noise, and where your signal input is you're modeling your signal essentially as Gaussian noise plus this FIR filter, you can actually show that this will converge in the mean to the true solution. So under certain conditions, you can get convergence of this, and therefore, this has been a very effective approach in the past. And people do this in software all the time just by clipping these sums to be not to be less than one if you're dealing with, for example, 16-bit integer data. Now, another thing that you might think of pretty quickly is that you would like to use the adaptation constant that varies as a function of time. What that means is that you might like your coefficients to vary quickly initially when they're far off from the true solution, but then as they get closer to the true solution, which you don't really know, but you can sort of estimate where you are relative to convergence, you'd like maybe to use a smaller adaptation factor so that you can converge to a finer solution. So one simple-minded approach to doing this would be to have alpha of n be proportional to 1 over n plus c, where c is a constant and n is time. This means that as time increases, the alphas are going to go to zero, independent of what's really happening with the filter. And this was proposed fairly early on. This problem of time adaptation has actually been studied extensively in the context of neural networks. That's one of the first places where we saw a lot of work on adaptation strategies. And typically what's done in neural networks are, you'll see solutions that are based on velocity or gradients, and you'll see solutions that are based on velocity and acceleration, which is the second derivative. And then a lot of variants of that in between. One approach discussed here is called the variable step algorithm. In this approach, we have an update equation which says that fn plus 1 is equal to f sub n plus the error signal e of n times a matrix m sub n times the data vector x sub n. The matrix m sub n is a diagonal matrix that has time varying values along the diagonal. So we have alpha sub 0 of n for the 0 comma 0 element or 1 comma 1 element, alpha 1 of n, and so forth. So this is a generalization of this kind of a concept in that each filter coefficient has its own adaptation constant. And also each of these coefficients are allowed to be a function of time. The step sizes are determined heuristically, such as examining the sine of the instantaneous gradient, e sub n times xn minus I. This is the correction term associated with the ith coefficient. And we could, for example, make these alphas proportional to that. So this is a generalized approach to variable step size adaptation. Now, this is a little bit of overkill, and in fact, we won't say much more about this because of that, but if you think about your filters having 160 coefficients, it doesn't really make much sense to have 160 adaptation constants. So in fact, what's typically done is to just use one constant for all the filter coefficients. But if your filter coefficients have different statistical properties, and if your filter coefficients are have a significant difference in scale, for example, you know, there may be the smallest coefficient may be 1/1000th of the amplitude of the largest coefficient, you may want to consider something like this, because for the large amplitude coefficients, you're going to need a larger correction factor to get the same rate of convergence as you will for the small coefficients. Because our adaptation equation is directly proportional to E of n times X sub n, each coefficient in your filter you can think of as having a different dynamic range, needing a different scaling of this error term. And that's essentially what algorithms like this try to do. And you know, you can do all sorts of crazy things. You can actually have the constants, you can write an equation for this time adaptation as a digital filter, and you can estimate the digital filter coefficients as part of the adaptation process, sort of a double recursion, and a lot of other signal DSP tricks you can apply to that, but again, you know, that's, I think, beyond the scope of this course, and those kinds of things aren't really used that much in practice. The next thing we want to talk about is it's actually one of my favorite topics in DSP, this notion of leaky accumulation or leaky integration. So we'll formally define what's called the leaky LMS algorithm. And to do this, we'll consider an LMS update modified to include a constant leakage factor. So we'll write that the filter coefficients Fn plus 1 is equal to, instead of just Fn, F sub n now, we're going to have gamma times F sub n plus alpha times E of n times X sub n. So this is our normal, this alpha term is our normal correction term, but we've introduced a term gamma, which is between 0 and 1. Now, I'm hoping you've seen some of this in your DSP classes so you understand where this kind of thing comes from. We'll talk about it a little bit now. Under what conditions would it be advantageous to employ such a factor? Well, before you answer that, let's ask yourself, what does this gamma factor do from a digital signal processing point of view? If this were a digital filter, y of n is equal to gamma y of n minus 1 plus x of n, what does gamma effectively do in that digital filter? And you've hopefully seen this kind of an analysis in your DSP class. A digital filter, y of n is equal to gamma y of n minus 1 plus x of n. That's a simple first order filter. What kind of frequency response does that filter have? So that's an indication that you might want to, at some point, review some of your DSP. That's a low-pass filter. its impulse response is going to be an exponential, gamma to the power n. And filters of that form are essentially low-pass filters where the term gamma controls the bandwidth of the filter. Now, hopefully what you learn from DSP, your DSP course, is that most every DSP structure you look at is essentially a low-pass filter, whether we're talking about averaging, whether we're talking about first-order, second-order filters. These all essentially act as low-pass filters. And the key design constraint with a low-pass filter is essentially the bandwidth. And the bandwidth influences how much smoothing you do on the signal. If you set the bandwidth to be very narrow, let's say 100 hertz, 0 to 100 hertz low-pass filter, you're going to get a lot of smoothing. If you set the bandwidth very large, let's say 0 to 1,000 hertz, you're going to get less smoothing. These leakage factors, this is essentially a low-pass filter, where the amount of smoothing that you're going to get from gamma depends on the strength of gamma. If gamma is equal to 0, that says that your coefficient values are simply going to be the correction term. If gamma is equal to 1, that says the coefficient values are going to be what we've derived as the rigorous solution to the LMS adaptation. And gamma in between will essentially control how quickly this filter responds to adaptation components or these air term components. So with gamma, as gamma approaches 0, you're essentially forgetting the previous value of the filter coefficients and you're relying solely on the correction term, which means the coefficients are going to fluctuate very rapidly. With gamma approaching 1, you're going to get smoother behavior. So that's sort of the DSP properties of this equation. Now the question is, in an adaptive signal processing context, under what conditions would it be advantageous to employ such a factor? A forgetting factor, if you will. Well, suppose your filter coefficients are adapting at a very slow rate. And suppose you're using this filter in a context like cellular telephony, where you encounter a lot of non-stationary, impulsive-type noises. So your filter adapts very slowly. This impulsive noise comes along, like a bang or a car rolls by a truck rolls by your car and your windows open and your microphones are picking all this up. Why might it be advantageous to use a factor like this? If you want your system to respond to impulsive noises or to changes in the environment, what benefits do you get out of a coefficient like this? Well, if your coefficients are adapting at a fairly slow rate, the problem with that is going to be when a change happens, it's going to take a long time for that change to propagate to your filter coefficients. And if you have an impulsive noise, you may not even have enough time to adapt to that noise because about the time you've started to adapt to it, the noise is already gone.
I have a problem. Usually I see those equations, but they use gamma multiply Fn plus 1 minus gamma plus.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. That's actually a better approach. But you can also think of the 1 minus gamma as being folded into the alpha. We could actually write this as gamma plus 1 minus gamma times alpha. And And that would actually be a better, that's sort of a more rigorous way to do this, because now you're trading contributions between the memory and the new terms. And that's actually, that's why if you haven't seen this in your DSP classes, it's kind of a shame. When I teach DSP, I talk a lot about this, because this gamma times 1 minus gamma is a very, very powerful way to do digital filtering. But the concept is the same here, that you're essentially controlling, this gives you some control over the ability of the filter to adapt to impulsive noises quickly, but at the same time to control sort of the amount of smoothing that you get out of the filter. So the drawbacks are that, you know, sort of it's a two-way street. You can adapt to, by setting gamma to zero, for example, or close to zero, you can adapt very quickly to changes in the input, unexpected changes in the input. But the problem with that is that you're going to then fluctuate a lot. You're going to have trouble converging because you're always going to be oscillating. So, you know, naturally people think about even making gamma to be adaptive in itself, depending on some things you're monitoring about the input signals. We can play all these kinds of games. And we do, in fact, in some systems do that. Now, we can, in this case, sort of do a nice little derivation to show that this introduces some bias. So if we substitute our expressions for the error term E of n and the desired signal D of n into this update equation, we can actually write this as Fn plus 1 is equal to gamma times the matrix I minus alpha times X sub n transpose times F sub n, plus alpha times D of n times X sub n. We actually did this way back when we did the LMS derivation, so you've seen an equation like this before. The only new thing now is instead of having just I here, we have gamma times I. And you can begin to see where this is headed, that's going to introduce a bias into the coefficients. So we can take the expectation of both sides of this equation, and we can write that expectation of F sub n plus 1 is equal to, well, all of this stuff is a constant, so the expectation, except the, when we take the expectation of this, the gamma I is a constant. We have the expectation of alpha xn xn transpose. Well, we can just pull the alpha out, and the expectation of xn xn transpose is just the autocorrelation. Again, we did that derivation a couple weeks ago, and then we just have the expectation of F sub n. And then on this last term, the expectation of D of n times X sub n is this cross-correlation term we call G. So we can rearrange this a little bit and show that we have I minus alpha times the quantity R plus 1 minus gamma over alpha times I times the expectation of F sub n plus alpha times G. And that's an informative equation, because we can show that the limit as n goes to infinity of this expectation approaches this term R plus 1 minus gamma over alpha I inverse times G. And that's informative, because this shows us that the gamma, if gamma is equal to 1, we have no bias. If gamma is equal to 0, we have a lot of bias. So it shows us that there's a bias. Introducing these kinds of heuristics does introduce a bias into the LMS solution. And it brings out more strongly the fact that this gamma is a compromise between introducing bias and trying to make the coefficients kind of behave well. So in the lower right here, we have a plot of an example of how this impacts convergence. The solid line here, which is a little hard to see, is the true value of the coefficients. And then these other lines are four different values of gamma. As gamma gets larger, the bias gets larger. So these are actually ordered by the value of gamma. And it shows you quite nicely that as you make gamma larger, as you make gamma smaller, the bias gets larger. But, you know, bias isn't necessarily bad if you're dealing with a non-stationary signal like a speech signal. because you never really converge to the true coefficients, because the coefficients are always changing. So theoretically you may say bias is bad, but in practice this coefficient protection, ensuring nice stable convergence of these coefficients, may be more important to you than bias removal. Okay, so the next thing I wanted to briefly talk about is another simplification we can make to the adaptation equations. In applications where you're processing data at very, very high speeds, you may not actually have the computational power to compute this term E of n, X of n, which is required to get the adaptation constant. But it's actually possible to update the coefficients based on just the sign of this correction term. And there's actually some theoretical motivation for that. If we define a cost function as the absolute value of E of n rather than as the expectation of the absolute value rather than the expectation of the square, we can actually derive these simple algorithms. Another way to think about these algorithms are, this is just it's sort of a one-bit differential prediction algorithm. We talked last time about ADPCM, and we talked about how in the limit you could actually convert ADPCM into a one-bit technique called delta modulation, and that's actually one of the motivations for this. If you sample sufficiently high, you can adapt just by the sign, just by one bit, and still converge, because you're still just adding small increments to the coefficients, and over time those will accumulate to allow you to reach the correct signal. The only problem is the convergence of this may be slower than using the full-blown computation, because you're averaging less of the knowledge about the signal in this. There are three variants of this. There's something called the sine algorithm, where the correction term is just alpha times the sine of the error times x of n. That gets you a little bit of relief, because this is just a matter of taking the instantaneous sine of the error. If you're wondering where these things came from, well, if you've ever programmed down at the bit level and you've dealt with numeric representations of data, the sine bit's always available to you fairly easily. You can just mask that off of the bit of the code word for the sample. So from a hardware point of view, it's really easy to come up with the sine of the signal, and that's why these kinds of techniques were popular and are still popular in some high-speed equipment. There's also a variant of this called the clipped LMS or sine regressor, where you take E of n times the sine of x of n, and there's the zero forcing LMS or sine algorithm, where you take the product of the sines of both. And these algorithms are approximations. The sine algorithm is actually used in the CCITT ADPCM standard. And the reason for that was there was a lot of effort put into making this algorithm run on what was a single chip being defined back in 1980, which was a chip that had a fairly small amount of processing power. So they did everything possible to reduce the computations of the algorithm, and that's why they used this kind of an approach. Now, the next thing that we can do, in addition to simply playing with how we update the coefficients, we can actually smooth the estimate of the correction term. And there are a couple ways you could do that. One way would be to take the correction term and actually process it through a low-pass digital filter and produce smoothed estimates of that correction term. If you think about that process long enough, you'll realize, well, another way to do the same kind of thing is to just take an average of E of j times X of j or the error term times the signal, rather than just taking a single value. Now, this is sort of a step backwards. This is starting to look a little bit more like a block-oriented least mean squared error approach. And we began this section of the course saying that we'd really like the algorithm to be able to respond to instantaneous changes in the signal. So we preferred a solution that was just e times x. But now we're relaxing that a little bit and suggesting that we can use a sliding window approach, essentially, and at every point in time, we can take a sum of n previous samples of this correction term and essentially average them. And this is what's called the averaged LMS algorithm. A more general form of this would be to use a low-pass filter on the sequence e of n times x of n minus I. And this filter could be, you know, FIR, IIR, whatever flavor you like. But this gives you some amount of smoothing of this estimate. So it's a balance between totally instantaneous and totally block-oriented. And in a moment, after my next slide, it'll become a little clearer why you might be interested in this. But a popular variant of this is known as the momentum LMS filter, which is essentially, like was suggested, taking a 1 minus gamma times the error term plus gamma times the new term. So we have f sub n plus 1 is equal to f sub n times, we have 1 minus gamma times the change in the coefficients from the previous term to the next term. So that's sort of giving you some kind of what's called momentum term. And then we have gamma times our existing correction term, alpha e of n x of n. Now, if you think about this hard enough from a DSP point of view, this is just a filter implementation. So this is essentially a digital filtering of this correction term. The other nice thing about this, though, is you're able to balance how much you use the previous knowledge. If fn and fn minus 1 are very close, this term will go to 0. If these are very different, this term will be very large. So the gamma allows us to control trade-off how much the history of the filter is weighted against the newest values of the filter. So this is called the momentum LMS filter, and it gives you yet another parameter to sort of adjust. We can even go nonlinear on this and write that the coefficients are updated using alpha times the median value of the previous values of the error signal times times x. And we can call that a median LMS, and this is a nonlinear approach. And you can think, well, there's many different things I could do besides median. But this is an approach where you essentially, instead of using the sum of the squares or using a filtering, you're saying that the median value of the error signal over some window of time is what I'm going to use for the correction factor. And, I don't know the people that, I don't know many applications that use this in practice, but of course, these kinds of nonlinear methods were researched pretty heavily. And in fact, most, in software, it's very, very easy to implement nonlinear algorithms. We do this all the time. Like, we might check overflow, underflow, or if this value is less than 0, set it equal to 0. So people actually, do these kinds. In actual implementations, there's always some amount of nonlinearity because you have to check exception conditions and things like that. There's many variants of these kinds of things. A lot of these variants focus on making this momentum term, dependent on second derivatives, third derivatives, that kind of thing. Now, in addition to this smoothing using the sum of the previous n samples of the correction term, we can also introduce something known as the block LMS algorithm. And I wanted to talk briefly about this because this is what's used in the echo canceller along with the block smoothing. So the two kind of go together. So there's no need to update coefficients every sample. We can update coefficients every n samples and use a block update for the coefficients. So let me, before I explain the equations, let me just comment on that. In the early days of adaptive filters, you could not afford to update coefficients every sample. But you still wanted a recursive, iterative algorithm. So the question became, if I maybe I can update every other sample, or every third sample, or every fourth sample. How often do I have to update these coefficients so that I track the dynamics of my signal? Well, that question has been well studied. That is essentially what DSP is all about in some ways. You can look at the bandwidth of your signal, you can look at the stationarity of your signal, and you can then predict at what rate you need to be updating your coefficients to get a reasonable solution. With voice signals, with speech, we know that the signal is relatively stationary when viewed on time intervals of about 5 milliseconds. So there's no need to update coefficients every sample. It's more common in voice processing to update coefficients 5, 10, 20, 30 milliseconds, something on that order. In modern day systems, we compute features, for example, every 10 milliseconds. But when you do that, you don't want to just do a simple update of E times X, because that's throwing away all these values of E times X between the last time you updated your coefficients and the current time. So what's done is to essentially combine the two and not only update every n samples, but use m or samples of data to do that update. So we can use the smoothing and the block update together. And that's essentially what we're suggesting here, is that every n samples, we update the coefficients using a correction term, which is a smoothed estimate of the error times the signal. So in this, with this equation, every n samples, we're using the previous n samples to do this update. Another way to do this is to actually use the update period n is independent of the analysis window m. And we talked about that a few weeks ago, how in most real systems, you have this sliding window and you allow some kind of overlap so that you can control the rate at which your coefficients change. So here we have the equations laid out for this block algorithm, and they're just notationally a little bit complicated, but all that's really going on here is that every n samples, we're updating the coefficients, and we're using some amount of data previous to that point in time to create the smoothed estimate. And in this case, we're using all n, the number of samples used for the smoother, and the number of samples between updates are the same, but they don't necessarily have to be that way. The block algorithm is nice because it essentially allows you to control the computations by the update rate and the number of samples you use in the smoothing estimate. You can control these independently. It's easy to show that this slows the convergence factor, but on the other hand, it gives you a smoother estimate, so it's another way to balance instantaneous change versus smoothing. And it does produce a different estimate than the per sample updates, but you know it in practice works fairly well. And many real algorithms actually prefer the block algorithms because they fit very nicely within the architecture of the hardware, which tends to want to do vector multiply adds rather than per sample multiply adds. Because often in real hardware, you buffer up the data and you process the data in buffers. You don't actually process it sample by sample. And if you aren't familiar with how real-time DSP works, well, again, I hope they covered that in your DSP class, but if not, I've got a DSP class online that talks a lot about these kinds of things. Okay, good. So the last thing I want to spend a little bit of time on is what's called a Volterra filter. And I want to talk about this because this gives you a different view. It sort of expands your view of digital filtering. Previously in your DSP courses, you've primarily discussed the linear filters that are linear constant coefficient difference equations, where you have an input x, you have weighted values of the input x, you have weighted values of the previous values of the output y, and you sum all those together to get your new output y. So y is equal to a sum of previous values of the output plus some weighted values of the input. Now, why is that model so popular in signal processing? If you guys can answer that question, I'll be very impressed. The digital filter model is not an accident. It's actually used for a reason that relates to the types of signal processing problems we apply it to. Just like the fact that we use autocorrelation functions, I'm giving you a hint here. The fact that we use autocorrelation functions is very heavily related to some of the common assumptions we make in our signal processing problems to make them more tractable. So when you're dealing with digital filtering, one of your primary goals is to remove noise from the system, right? That's a typical application of a digital filter. And you go about removing this noise by operating on the frequency response, essentially, and hoping that you can either, the signal has a different frequency response than the noise, and you can sort of separate them that way. Or maybe the signal is distorted, spectrally shaped by the system, and you want to restore that shape. When we model systems as signal plus noise, what assumptions do we make about the noise typically? White noise? What else? What does white noise mean?
They have flat spectrum.
Flat spectrum, okay, what else? We go further than white noise. Zero mean, that's an easy one. But one more word, very important. What assumptions do we make about the amplitude distribution of that noise?
Uncorrelated.
No. We make an assumption about the probability density function of the amplitude of the noise. Zero mean, you're missing one word, noise. G, the G word. Gaussian, right? When you say white noise, you're probably thinking zero mean Gaussian white noise, right? That's a phrase we use all the time.
AWGN.
What? AWGN. But remember that the noise can be white, but not Gaussian, and the noise can be Gaussian, but not white. Typically, in most analysis, we assume zero mean Gaussian white noise. Why? It's what? I think you said it.
It's simple.
Simple. And why is... Now, you took pattern recognition, so you know the answer to this. I beat this into you guys. Why is simple better most of the time? We can talk about Occam's razor, we can talk about Prince entropy, but in general, if you have to make a guess, you want to make the least constraining guess, so the chances of you being wrong on the average are smallest. So, very often in linear system theory, we assume zero mean Gaussian noise. Why? What's special about the statistical properties of the Gaussian noise? Why is it the least constraining assumption?
Mean
and variance, right? And this is why, essentially, digital filtering, as you know it, with linear constant coefficient difference equations, it's sort of synonymous with this assumption about Gaussian noise. Because these filters work very well when your signals have these simple statistical properties. You can compute a correlation function, you can relate properties of that correlation function to the signal and noise. Yes, we want the signal to be uncorrelated with the noise, and you mentioned that earlier. But what happens if, in practice, your noise is not Gaussian? What is the impact of that in terms of its correlation structure? Well, you said zero Gaussian noise has this nice property of mean, variance, and everything else is zero, the higher order moments, right? What happens if the noise is not Gaussian? The higher order moments are non-zero. If you're dealing with such a situation, you can actually construct filters that operate on those higher order moments as well as operating on the first and second moments. And this is what Volterra filtering is all about. You see Volterra worked in general, he's a famous mathematician, but he worked on chaotic or nonlinear type analysis. And when you have signals that exhibit properties like chaos, you're dealing with signals whose higher order moments are very strong. And therefore, we want some way to model those. And the Volterra filter is a way of doing that. Because you can see here, we essentially have a linear filter here, but then we have these terms based on higher order moments of the signal. Now, probably you haven't seen this in your DSP classes, but this is a very well-developed technology, and it's usually covered in a course like nonlinear system theory. So if we're faced with this kind of a structure, we can actually define an adaptive filter that uses this framework but still allows you to adapt the coefficients using the kind of normal equations we're used to. And I guess that's a pun on the word normal, but the only difference is these vectors are going to be a little more complicated because they're going to have information about the first, the second moment correlations, but then they're also going to have information about the higher order moments in them. Now, I'm not going to go through the extended derivation of this today, but I just wanted to sketch how this works. We still define a cost function, which is a quadratic error term. But the thing we have to do now, instead of just differentiating with respect to f superscript 1 of j's, which is the linear component, we now have to also differentiate with respect to the nonlinear components. And not surprisingly, if you can actually write this in a form that looks like our normal equation, the correlation matrix times F is equal to G. But the correlation matrix, each of these vectors is essentially an extended vector which has elements of the linear term and elements of the nonlinear term concatenated. So the coefficient vector we write as first a set of linear the linear coefficients And then we append to that the nonlinear coefficients. And here we have the the description of those vectors. But you can just see that this F superscript 1 is just a set of the linear coefficients, and then this F superscript 2 is a set of the nonlinear coefficients. And then if we carry that through, we actually end up with a correlation matrix which has our standard correlation terms here, but then it's got these terms related to to the higher order moments, and I think this should be R sub 3 transpose. This term on the lower left, I'll correct that. But the matrix essentially becomes, it's a matrix which can be decomposed into contributions that reflect our standard correlations, but now you also see the impact of these correlations between the linear term. R3 is the correlation between the linear term and the quadratic term, and R4 is the autocorrelation of the quadratic terms. And again, we've written the data vectors that correspond to these. And the extended cross-correlation vector, again, sort of has a similar form. It's going to be a composition of our linear component and our nonlinear component. And if you do all this and you work through the math, lo and behold, you can arrive at two sort of decoupled equations for updating the coefficients, where for the linear term, we have contributions that are associated with the things we're normally used to. The linear, this is essentially our linear update equation. But now for the nonlinear terms, you end up with an update that's related to the higher order terms. Now, these equations are actually not, there's some assumptions associated with these equations about the relationship of this matrix. The assumption here is actually that this matrix, these off-diagonal terms are zero. So this is not a direct result of this generalized correlation matrix. But what I want to just mention this because it's a form of filtering you haven't seen before, but you can see the power of these simple adaptive algorithms. You can usually create very tractable re-estimation equations for the coefficients. And that's why LMS algorithms are so popular, because they're such a simple approximation that you can solve a large number of more complicated problems with them. And in the case of signals that are truly non-Gaussian, these kinds of filters actually have been somewhat effective. They're used in fact, a number of communication systems now use this chaotic approach to signaling, because it's a very good way to scramble information, for example. Very hard to break or hack a system when you're using this random modulation, because you look at the spectrum and you can't see the signal. It looks so much like noise, and yet you can recover that signal using these higher order statistics. So it's an interesting area of research. It's a very active area of research over the past 10 years, and I just wanted to introduce it today so you get some idea that we can actually use more complicated filter structures and still estimate the parameters of those filters using this great simple gradient approach. And therefore, you'll see in many, many engineering systems, you'll see many kinds of nonlinear equations estimated using this adaptive or gradient descent type approach. Okay, so today we've introduced a number of new LMS algorithms. We showed that you can do a lot of different variants of the gradient. You can do a lot of different variants of how you update the coefficients, and then you can do a lot of variants in how you smooth the coefficients. And then we concluded by talking about how you can design and implement filters that exploit higher order statistical information. And we pointed out that this is important when you're dealing with non-Gaussian noise. And noise can be white, but non-Gaussian. So, in fact, most noise in the real world is non-Gaussian. The good news is it can often be approximated by fairly well by Gaussian assumptions. Okay, so I will see you on Tuesday. And we'll talk about recursive least mean square LMS, recursive LMS algorithm.